Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Today on the show, we're going to the movies. I'm going to talk with filmmakers behind three new music documentaries. And what I like about each of these films is that it's not just great Latin soul or great Balkan brass music, but each film is full of surprises and takes us to some pretty unlikely places. Now, that's coming up in a moment, but first, we've been celebrating music from the summer of 94 all this month on the show. Here's a message we received from our listener, Martina, after our recent conversation with the comedian Hari Kondabolu about the band Weezer. They made their debut album in 1994, popularly known as the Blue Album. Here's Martina.
Hi, I'm so excited to hear that we're talking about Weezer because I have a Weezer tattoo that I got when I was 18 years old, 1999, and I am now 32, and I will never be able to get rid of it. Anyway, I still like it, I don't mind it, and I like telling the story of it.
What? That's it? She didn't tell... Joel, yep. She didn't tell the story! Get me Martina on the line.
Okay, John.
Jeez, people, come on. You can't tell us that you have a great story and then not... What the hell is that? Is that our phone?
Yep, rotary dial, John. Next month, we're doing the summer of 1894.
Oh, my God.
Okay, all right, John, she's there. We got her.
Oh, okay. Martina from Brooklyn, you said you had a story, and then you didn't tell us the story, so...
I called you, and then I got nervous, and I was like, what am I doing? And I hung up.
Well, now we're going to put your feet to the fire and get all the gory details about this tattoo. First of all, what is it?
Well, whenever I say I have a Weezer tattoo, everyone assumes it's the Flying W. That's what their logo's called. That real Weezer fans know that. But it's not the Flying W. It's the word devotion, which was a B-side from the international release of El Scorcho, the single.
Wow. So a deep cut.
I'm pretty proud of it. People who know what it is, they're really in the know.
And where is this tattoo?
It's on my wrist. It's on the inside of my wrist. It takes up the entire width of my wrist. You can't miss it. It's
okay.
Black ink in a terrible font that I chose when I was 18.
And how did you get it?
Well, my prom date and I were just so into the band, and we made a full Weezer mixtape to go to prom, and we played it in the limo to prom, and it was just our special thing. And then he actually got the devotion tattoo first, and I saw it, and I just said, that's what I need. Like, that is a really important thing for me to have. So then I got it right after him.
So 15 years later, how do you feel about it?
Well, as a tattoo, you know, as a visual item, it's kind of ugly. It's not like a beautiful tattoo, but it has a neat story and a neat memory. And I went to his wedding just about a year ago, and that was really cool to show his wife our silly tattoos.
Yeah, I'm sure she was really pleased to see that.
Yeah, I know.
Ex-girlfriend of my brand new husband, and they have matching tattoos.
Yeah.
What is this about?
She was good about it.
All right. So do you have a favorite Weezer? I mean, you mentioned Hari Kondabolu, who was our guest talking about them. You might remember that Hari was saying that he liked the first and the second Weezer records. He liked the Blue Album, he liked Pinkerton, and didn't like anything after that. What about you?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like that's the law. There is only the Blue Album and Pinkerton. I mean, everything else is okay, but Pinkerton really is the one. That's the album.
All right, Martina. Well, it is a nice story behind that tattoo. Thanks very much for sharing it with us.
Yeah, thank you. You know this is breaking me up.
Get You from the album Pinkerton by Weezer, a band memorialized on the wrist of our listener Martina in Brooklyn. Okay, now, soundcheck goes to the movies.
Okay, that's the lick. Ah, B-B. Bang, bang. Ah! He said, we're going to record this.
That is how the film called We Like It Like That begins, with the song Bang Bang by the Joe Cuba Sextet. The film charts the startling rise of Boogaloo, sometimes known as Latin Soul, in the 1960s. But it also looks at Boogaloo's controversial death in the 70s and its unexpected revival today. Joining me here in the Soundcheck studio is the director of We Like It Like That, Matthew Ramirez Warren. Matthew, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
As well as Joe Batan, the Boogaloo band leader and one of the main subjects of the film. Joe, good to have you back on Soundcheck.
Oh, it's back. It's nice to be here. Thank you, John.
So let's, Matthew, let me ask you to start by defining our terms here.
Sure.
Boogaloo. How does it differ from all the other species of Latin music that are out there?
Well, Boogaloo is very much a product of New York City, a product of the melting pot. It's Latin music fused with sort of an R&B soul style. And it's just, you know, a very funky, groovy sound, very mm-hmm. representative of New York in the 1960s.
So, Joe, for you, was it, you know, is this a kind of a reflection of the music you grew up listening to?
Yes, actually, you know, growing up, we listened to the jukeboxes and what was on the top 40.
Top 40, sure.
40. So we mixed this two cultures, the Latin with the clave and soul. And we put this together, and then we had this boogaloo backbeat of a cha-cha.
And the results pretty quickly caught people's ear. Here's Joe Batan with his classic song, Gypsy Woman. Ha, ha, she's broke. Ha,
ha, she's broke. Ha, ha. Some come from nowhere to watch this caravan. Gypsy woman. They come from sunlight to moonlight to see my gypsy in motion.
Batan and his song Gypsy Woman. Joe, what year was that?
Actually recorded in 1965 and released in 1966.
All right, Joe Batan obviously here on Soundcheck. So is Matthew Ramirez Warren, the director of the new film We Like It Like That, which charts the checkered history of Boogaloo. Joe, the last time you were on Soundcheck, we were talking about your song Subway Joe because mm-hmm. the Metropolitan, you know, the Transit Authority was doing that big exhibit of Subway.
Yes.
New York City Subways on album covers, mm-hmm. Which just goes to Matthew's point that he made earlier that this was a New York City phenomenon.
Without a doubt.
It's Latin music,
mm-hmm.
but it's New York music.
Yes, it was.
Well, I took the subway downtown one day just to buy me some Chinese.
It was from the streets of El Barrio, and you could feel the pulse of the kids dancing in the street. They knew it belonged to them. When they got into the dance floor at the Colgate Gardens in the Bronx, where else could you go and pay a dollar and dance all day from 12 o'clock afternoon all the way into the evening?
And Matthew, you have some remarkable footage of New York City, of people dancing in the streets and stuff. And where did you get that?
Well, it's been honestly about a 5-year process to make this film, and you know, just looking at all the archival footage collections that I could find, and anything I could find relating to New York and specifically the Latino communities of New York in that era.
Well, at one point, Johnny Colon is at the piano, and he's sort of explaining how he got to his big hit tune called "Boogaloo Blues." And that turns out to be one of the signature songs in this style in the 60s. Johnny Colon.
See, that's the blues element.
George Goldner signed us to Kotik Records. He'd been in the business for a long, long time. He had the ability to put his finger on something that he heard that he thought was going to be a hit. Like Boogaloo Blues, when he heard me doing the riff on the piano.
That's what I was doing. He said, don't do this. Stay with...
That's Boogaloo Blues, Johnny Colon, and a big hit. And you know, Boogaloo is right there in the title, Matthew. So, you know, it's kind of emblematic of this, this style of New York music in the 60s. Matthew Ramirez Warren is the director of the film called We Like It Like That, which focuses on people like Johnny Colon and Pete Rodriguez and Joe Batan, the Boogaloo band leader who's also here with me on Soundcheck today. Joe, you are performing with the Boogaloo Assassins as part of the Fania 50th anniversary party and summer stage is involved, although this is not at Central Park. It's at Clove Lakes Park on Thursday, July 31st. Clove Lakes Park on Staten Island. Free show at 7 p.m. And again, both Joe and Matthew here with us in the Soundcheck studio today. So the documentary is tied to the 50th anniversary of Fania, which is the record label that a lot of these guys were on. And despite being tied to that, it is not like, you know, a poem in praise of Fania.
Right.
In fact, some of the guys talk pretty openly about missing royalties, abusive contracts and stuff like that. You know, that was part of the story too.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to understand that what is Fania now is not necessarily connected to what was Fania then. Of course, completely different ownership.
Right.
And also, while Fania was one of the labels during that era, there were many other labels as well. So the artists were talking about those other labels as well, like Kotik, Tico, Alegre.
Well, now that, you know, Joe, this is one of the things that some of, you know, some of the old Boogaloo band leaders are saying in the film is like, we're reaching Latinos, we're reaching black and white audiences, we're selling, you know, 250,000 records, and we're not seeing any money.
That's true.
There was success, but it wasn't maybe, you know, being remunerated.
Right. The monetary point was never there. It's a shame because those labels were responsible for bringing the music out.
Right.
Don't get me wrong. The only thing is that a lot of those artists never got paid what they were worth, you know, and that's the shame of it.
Yeah. So this documentary is called We Like It Like That, which is clearly a riff on the famous song by Pete Rodriguez, right?
Yes.
And certainly this was one of the high water marks of Pete Rodriguez's career. Pete Rodriguez and his Boogaloo hit called I Like It Like That. The film is called We Like It Like That, directed by Matthew Ramirez Warren, who's here with me on Soundcheck. So is Joe Batan, the Boogaloo band leader and one of the subjects of the film. And Joe, there was a generation of, you know, Latin musicians here in New York before you guys, people like Tito Puente and Machito. And you know, what was the reaction from that camp when you and Johnny Colon and Pete Rodriguez come along and you got the big band and you got the big sales and you got the big audiences?
Well, there was a little animosity because we were taking a lot of the work that those bands were used to. And actually, our style of playing mixed in salsa, but we did not only play Boogaloo, right? But what the Boogaloo that we played was very difficult for the other old guard to play. Mm-hmm. They weren't used to that, so they didn't have the singer. And, of course, there was animosity, and you name the names, the booking agents, they went out of their way to try to get them booked, and they had no success because we had all the jobs. All the Boogaloo bands for the next 3-4 years had all the jobs.
Matthew, to me, one of the really interesting kind of arcs of the narrative of your film is Boogaloo appears out of this younger generation here in New York. It sort of rockets to ascendancy. And then there are the various conspiracy theories about who or what killed Boogaloo. So I want to play a clip from your film and then just tell me who we're listening to here and how this sort of fits into the story. Listen.
They decided to do away with it. They completely destroyed it. From one day to another, it was gone.
Top band leaders were losing money to these teenagers who would be happy to walk away with $15, $20. Something had to be done. Certain companies actually paid the radio DJs to stop playing Boogaloo music.
The first person you heard there was Elliot Rivera, who was a singer for the LeBron Brothers. The next person you heard was Bobby Marin, who was a songwriter and producer who had quite a bit of success during the Boogaloo era.
And so what do you make of they both, and there are other voices as well, that all seem to be chiming in saying, hey, we were killed off by an industry that saw us as a threat. What do you make of that?
Well, we try to put forth all sides in the film.
Well, since you say that, let me skip ahead just a few seconds in the film. Listen to this.
What really killed Boogaloo is they had that big hit by Johnny Colonel, you know, Boogaloo Blues, which was... You know, it was like the song of the 60s, you know? And then they had I Like It Like That by Pete Rodriguez. They had Bang Bang. And then what did they have? They didn't have any more hits. That's what killed Boogaloo. There were three big hits.
So that was actually Alex Masucci, the brother of Jerry Masucci.
The founder of Fania Records.
Jerry Masucci passed away. But we wanted to try and get someone from that camp in the film expressing their opinions. And, you know, the point he's trying to make was it didn't have the reach to last.
And then there's another side, which comes shortly after in the film, where one of the musicians actually says, look, it may have just run its course. Joe, did it run its course? I mean, it seems...
No.
It seems like Boogaloo never really went away if you knew where to look for it.
When Matthew first came to me and approached me, I said, if you're not going to tell the truth in this film, don't bother me. You see, I was edited out of the first documentary that Fania did, and certain things that I said, nobody touched the subject. Actually, they were told to not play my record because I was the first rebel or radical person to leave the label, and I tried to organize the bands for health care. It's criminal today that a lot of these band members can't even pay for their funeral. Their music goes on and on and on, and nobody's saying anything. They're not having these record companies being held accountable. Now they're not in existence. But the fact is that it's criminal.
So when you say, you know, that they were sort of pushing back at you because you were the first to leave, this back in the 70s, or
yes.
Is this still happening now?
Yes. No, well, they can't do it now because... Okay. I've already blossomed.
Yeah,
you know, I've shown that I didn't live by Fania alone because I went and approached and I did Sal Soul. So they can't say that.
Now, Sal Soul, your record label that you formed, is sort of this kind of combination of salsa and soul music. And salsa is what, you know, Fania becomes known for, Matthew, in the 70s with great success. And, you know, it's kind of weird to think that the thing that comes after Boogaloo is actually more traditional.
Well, you know, it's an interesting journey as you go from Boogaloo to salsa. Yes, we have our conspiracy theories and our industry politics that played into that, but also you have to understand there was cultural politics. And, it was a time of, you had the Black Power movement. And in turn, Latinos too, you know, took on a sense of empowerment and sort of a shift from kind of trying to assimilate in some ways to saying, you know what, wait, like, I'm proud of being Latino, I'm proud of my Latin music, I want to listen to my music in Spanish. At the same time, the Latin music industry in New York shifts its push to sell records now, not just within New York and within the U.S., but really they realize that they can push records to South America. And that's how Fania and Salsa really become as big as it went on to be.
And Boogaloo is pushed back into the shadows, but as somebody says later on in the film, it never really goes away, and it's like the DJs who are crate digging and are finding this stuff and keeping it alive.
That's definitely true. You got to give credit to the DJs. And not to toot my own horn, but that's how I came to discover this music. Was I was into collecting records, and I would go to the flea markets here in New York, and I just started finding all these great Latin records, but especially these songs that would be half English, half Spanish, with this kind of funky soul groove mixed in with the Latin rhythms. And I was like, what is this stuff? And it just made me very curious. And the main thing I realized when I listened to this music is this is really a product of New York, which I know I've said before, but it was important for me because I'm part Colombian, and growing up I'd heard Latin music all my life, but I always associated it with somewhere else, somewhere far, it's something foreign, not from New York. But realizing that, and I'm born and raised in New York, so finding this New York sound that was just so interesting to me was, you know, I needed to know more. I needed to know more about it.
Well, tomorrow on Soundcheck, we're going to be talking about, you know, the traditional and the experimental sides of Latin music coming together in bands like Juana Molina, the Argentine singer-songwriter, the New York band La Mecánica Popular. So there's still a lot of that happening. Is there a kind of a special place, Matthew, for Boogaloo in that musical spectrum?
I definitely think so. I mean, one of the DJs we feature in the film, DJ Termix, you know, he talks about how when he plays this music, he always often gets a reaction of people saying, "What is this from? Is this contemporary? Is this from now?" Because it really, it's kind of timeless. It's a timeless sound that you can put it on today, and you know, no matter what kind of audience, people will probably start moving, you know, tapping their feet, maybe nodding their head, and just getting into it, you know? So I can't see why not.
All right, well, as if to prove the point, we're going to wrap up with some music from the Boogaloo Assassins, a younger Boogaloo band playing with Joe Batan.
Yeah, right.
Thursday at Clove Lakes Park in Staten Island, 7 p.m., free concert. And on Friday the 1st, it's another of the Fania 50th anniversary events featuring DJ Termix and a live set from the Boogaloo Assassins at New Blue on Avenue C. That'll be 10 p.m. on Friday night, August 1st. We've been speaking with the Boogaloo band leader, Joe Batan, and with the filmmaker, Matthew Ramirez Warren. Matthew, Joe, great pleasure to have you guys with us today.
Thank you, John.
Thank
really
you so
appreciate
much.
It.
No, no, no.
We're spending the program today talking about new music documentaries. Next, a different side of Latin music on a different coast. We'll hear about the musician Mateo and the film made about him. And later, a spotlight on Balkan brass band music in the film called Brasslands. This is Soundcheck.
Muchas palabras por decir, muchas cosas sin hacer.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The documentary film Mateo tells the story of one of the more unusual figures in Latin music. Mateo is actually Matthew Stoneman, red-headed white guy from New Hampshire who learned mariachi music and a bit of Spanish while serving time for robbery in a California prison. Living in L.A., he becomes a kind of cult figure as the Gringo Mariachi. Sounds like a lighthearted, fish-out-of-water story, doesn't it? But the film has a surprising dark side. Yes, Mateo has a lovely voice, but he's a complicated guy, and he's almost shockingly okay about sharing that with the camera. Joining me in the Soundcheck studio is the director of the film, Aaron Narr. Aaron, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, John.
And with us on the line from L.A. is Mateo himself, Matthew Stoneman. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, how are you? Pleasure to be here.
Doing well. Now, Aaron, how did you find Mateo, and what made you think there was a story here to be told?
Well, when I first moved to Los Angeles, I was living on the east side, and I sort of heard about this character who was making his way through the restaurants, and his name was Mateo, and he was this white guy singing in Spanish in these, like, Mexican restaurants, and I was really intrigued by it. And then an LA Times article came out, and it said, Mateo is not the nice-looking, innocent guy you think he is. He actually learned to sing Spanish and play guitar in prison. And I said, this is odd. And I wanted to contact Mateo and to see if I could possibly do some sort of longer format piece on him to see if there are, you know, even more layers to peel away here. he was this, you know, short, red-haired guy who'd been to prison, and he spoke English but lived in East L.A. and spent most of his time in Cuba. There are just too many things that didn't really fit together at first sight.
Now, Matthew, when Aaron first starts filming you, you're in the process of making a record in Havana, Cuba. Did you know what you were getting into when Aaron first asked to follow along?
Not really. It took a while to get the, you know, for me to trust them and to build up a relationship with them. It was a little bit plodding at first, but yeah.
Now you moved to L.A. to be a musician, right?
Yeah, that was one of the things. I wasn't that driven when I first came out here. I had a friend that lived here, so I just thought, well, okay, I'll come out here and try it. But I wasn't that focused.
So music was an accident? Was it something that really didn't become important to you until you were in prison?
No, I'd always been a songwriter.
So when did you start writing songs in Spanish?
Oh, in Spanish? Yeah, in prison. You know, for instance, there were a few white guys playing guitar on the yard, doing a country rock, and yeah, I was kind of bored of that. And then there were some Mexicans doing their thing, and it was something new, something interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. You were in prison for robbery, right?
Yes, unfortunately, it's true, yes. I don't know, I just, I'd had a recording studio, I lost that, and I was down to nothing, and I don't know, I was a little bit out of my mind, too.
Yeah.
You know, or a lot out of my mind. And I don't know, I just, something snapped in me, and I recruited a few guys, and we robbed a music rental equipment place.
Huh. So the
$1 million worth of stuff, yeah.
So the robbery was to get musical equipment.
Well, that was the stuff I knew.
Yeah, you know, right.
I knew how to, you know, I knew its value.
So skip forward to the other side of the prison sentence. You've now learned Spanish. You're still a songwriter, and now you're writing songs in a style that owes more to maybe Cuban music than it does to Mexican mariachi, it seems. Would that be fair to say?
Well, in prison, I was writing a lot of songs that were more Mexican-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, maybe so afterwards. But Cuba and Mexico have the boleros in common. So it's, you know, it's almost one and the same.
Let's hear a little bit from Mateo, a.k.a. Matthew Stoneman. This song is called Cuando Vuelvan las Mariposas.
Tras volar mariposas caminamos y fue tu flota. Como una flor te acaricié, le diste un beso. Dime corazón. Dime si estarás o si me amarás en tu jardín cuando vuelvan las mariposas.
Recorded in Havana, Cuba, that is Mateo, Matthew Stoneman, the subject of the new film called Mateo, directed by Aaron Narr. Aaron's here with me in the studio. Matthew's on the line with us from L.A. The film screens on Monday, August 4th, at Lincoln Center's Walter Reed Theater at 9 p.m. Your film pivots around the 20-minute mark, where Matthew's in Havana, and he's staying at this house, and we see him walk into, you know, through a door, and the door closes behind him. Presumably, he's taking a shower or something. And there's a young woman sitting outside the door. Mm-hmm. After a moment, she giggles. She gets up, opens the door, closes it behind her. We then see her sandals on the floor. The implication is that she's now in there showering with him. And at that point, we are in a very, very different film. you know, where you're following Mateo as he's looking for prostitutes and he's seeing all these women and stuff. Was that a difficult story to tell? Was it difficult to make that pivot?
Well, absolutely. And it's actually that reason that I wanted to tell it, because it's really the experience that I went through trying to make this film. Because as we just sort of learned, Matthew has a very sordid past. It's sort of very complicated and hard to connect the dots. And the story that I saw and the character that I saw and the person that I was starting to understand revolved much more around this sort of second life in Cuba. And that I became much more fascinated with that, and it became much more reflective of who I thought Matthew was in present day, the essence of him. Because in Cuba, he has sort of a second family. He has friends. He has activities that he likes to do, places he likes to go, people he likes to see, and music that he likes to record.
Mm-hmm. Now, Matthew, you were okay with all of this stuff being filmed?
I guess. Aaron, you filmed me in the shower? No, I haven't seen the film. I don't know.
It's mostly just nudes. It's
okay, all right.
It's quite tasteful.
Now, they filmed so much that you just get kind of used to them filming. And even after they stopped filming, they left the sound going. You know, and I'd keep talking and talking. So I just got kind of used to it.
Now, why do you go to Havana? You make many trips to Havana, ostensibly to make this record. But it sounds like, from what Aaron is saying and from what we see in the film, it sounds like you can live a kind of a different life when you're in Havana. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a magical place. It's a beautiful place. Walking around there is so special, you know.
Well, at the end of one of Matthew's trips to Havana, he talks about having to return to L.A. This is from the film, Mateo.
It's just very sad because I hate leaving. Every time I leave, it's very emotional because I got to go back to Los Angeles. And I really, really don't like my situation in Los Angeles, my work. You know, now I just finished recording, so I'm way in debt. I have to work really hard, put myself in situations I don't want to be, sing in situations where they're not really listening. Just, I don't know. It's not where I want to be.
So, Matthew, what is that situation in L.A. that you didn't want to return to?
Well, sometimes I feel like I'm forced to, I need money, so I'll sing, and maybe they're not listening as much, and it's hurting my voice. You know, not every situation is ideal where they're really listening and way into it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not a Los Angeles kind of guy.
Well, Aaron, you allow Mateo to tell his own story for the most part. There's no narration. There are very few kind of intertitles. There is one, though, which says that after, I think, 7 years and $350,000, the album is finally done. And I'm left wondering, wow, where did $350,000 come from?
Mateo, you make a pretty good living in Los Angeles, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I sell a lot of records in Los Angeles, a lot of records. And I do make a good living out here. And it took me, I just love the process of recording. I've been recording in Havana since 2002. So I have literally hundreds of songs that are, tracks that I didn't release because I was still growing and I wasn't satisfied with it. And it wasn't until maybe the last 3 years or so where it really started to gel and I thought I was doing something special.
John, what I think is pretty interesting is that when Matthew is in Los Angeles, he's just there to work, and he works hard.
Well, I mean, as you show it, it seems like Matthew lives in a single room, a kind of incredibly messy single room, and basically eats fast food sandwiches, and that's it.
I mean, it's a cheap lifestyle.
Yeah, it is.
But it's because, Matthew, you want to spend all of your money recording, right? What else is there?
I've run through a lot of money recording, yeah.
So tell me about this song, Andando por el Malecón. What kind of, which of the Cuban rhythms is this using?
That's kind of just a traditional bolero. And the Malecón is the seawall around Havana where the lovers, they'll walk and, play guitar and drink rum. And it says, I don't want to walk down by the Malecón without you. But the middle part's very funny. It's with a girl, and I say, the moon is blue. And she says, no, it's white. I touch your hand, I remove it. So it's a little playful, yeah.
Let's hear a little bit. This is, once again, some music from Mateo, a.k.a. Matthew Stoneman, the subject of the new documentary called Mateo.
Acerco a ti,
me alejaré,
es tiempo ya,
muy pronto es,
para un beso,
tranquilo.
No quiero ser, no quiero estar, ver las estrellas.
It is Mateo and Andando por el Malecón from the album that has been released under the name Mi Linda Havana, recorded in Havana by my guest Matthew Stoneman, who's on the line with us from L.A. He's the subject of Aaron Narr's film called Mateo, which screens on Monday, August 4th at Lincoln Center's Walter Reed Theater at 9 p.m. Aaron's here in the studio. Matthew, as I say, on the line with us from L.A. Matthew, all of those musicians and the female singer all recorded in Havana, is that right?
Yes, yes, it's all recorded there.
So, yeah. Aaron, you find yourself in L.A., in Havana, and then, to everyone's surprise, at the end of the film, in Japan. How does that happen?
It was a very bizarre series of events, which is, I thought, sort of perfect for the story.
For this story, yeah.
I'm like, of course. Yes, of course he becomes famous in Japan. Matthew releases some of his music online, and he has a couple followers and people who buy his CD on something like CD Baby or iTunes. And one day he calls me. He goes, Aaron, you'll never guess what happened. And I go, what happened? He's like, a record label in Japan wants to sign me. And I'm like, oh, my God. I didn't think he was being serious, or I thought it was some sort of...
Did you think the film was over by then?
Well, the problem was, you know, it's he records so much that there's never really
an end.
You know, a different take, a new song. As he said, he has hundreds of songs that he has never released. So I don't even think Matthew knew where the album was going to end exactly. But now he had an opportunity to end it because someone said, I would like to release an album of your music. So then I said, okay, great. This is finally a natural end for our story. However, I had no idea that, you know, his career or his concerts or his following would really take off in Japan. I really had no sense of the seriousness of this endeavor.
Well, and it seems like people were singing along in this concert in Japan that you filmed.
Absolutely. I could not believe just the amount of celebrity, a minor celebrity, it seemed that he had there. It seems so bizarre. And the other nice thing was how easily he fit into the role.
Yeah.
You know?
So, Matthew, what has this done for you? Are you still living in that single room that we see so much of in the film and driving the same crappy car that we see in the film? Or have...
Yeah.
You're up in the Beverly Hills now? What's going on with you?
No, I'm still the same. Nothing's changed.
Oh my gosh.
I need a break.
You have to see the film. And I mean you, Matthew Stoneman, you need to see the film. And Soundcheck listeners, you should see it as well. It's called Mateo, directed by my guest Aaron Narr here in the studio and featuring Matthew Stoneman, a.k.a. Mateo, on the line with us from L.A. You can see the film 9 p.m. on Monday, August 4th at Lincoln Center's Walter Reed Theater, and there'll be a Q&A with Aaron as well. And guys, it is a very surprising film on many levels, and thank you both for being with us today.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure.
A Up next, Movie Night on Soundcheck continues as we turn to the new music documentary called Brasslands. It's about the biggest brass band competition in the world, which takes place in an otherwise tiny town in Serbia. That's next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The town of Guča in Serbia has a population of just over 2,000 people, except for August, when the annual trumpet festival brings in, and I'm not exaggerating here, something like 500,000 people. Most of them, of course, are Serbian, fans of the infectious Balkan brass bands and their crazy rhythms, but some of them come from elsewhere. One Balkan brass band that's taken part in the Guča competition is from right here in New York. And their story, plus the larger, more complicated story of the Serbian festival itself, is told in the documentary film Brasslands. And the producers of Brasslands join me here in the Soundcheck studio. They are Adam Pogoff. Hi, Adam.
Hi there.
And Brian Chang. Hey, Brian.
Hi, thanks for having us.
So, Brian, Balkan music has become kind of in vogue here in New York in recent years, right?
Yeah, definitely. There's a whole scene of hipsters and older people who are really into this music, and that's kind of how we gained entryway to this whole world that led us over to Serbia eventually was the scene right here in New York.
So there's indie bands like Beirut and Hawk and a Hacksaw who use the sounds of these Balkan rhythms and the brass instruments. And Adam, there's a great scene early in the film of the bands Latna Juste here in New York at the Grand Prospect Hall.
Golden Fest.
In Park Slope.
Yeah, every year on Martin Luther King Jr. weekend, there's a two-day festival called Golden Fest. People get to dance and experience the music on the same level as the musicians.
Now, but this band, Latna Juste, who are kind of central to Golden Fest, are also central players in your film. And we follow them as they go to Serbia. And, you know, just to, you know, to give an idea of what the band sounds like, it's pretty close to the sounds of real Balkan brass band music, but made right here in New York. And brass band music, New York style, from the group Zlatne Juste, who've been pioneering that sound here in New York for, got to be close to 30 years, right?
That's right.
Brian, how was it pretty clear early on that this was the band you guys were going to follow?
Zlatne Juste was actually the first Balkan brass band I had ever seen. Saw them in Barbez in Brooklyn, and Adam brought me to this concert, and it really floored me just listening to this stuff. We're both musicians, and the rhythms, I just like didn't know what time signature they were in. I'd never heard anything like that. So, you know, immediately there was kind of this thirst for something more. So we started thinking about how we might be making this movie about the 50th anniversary of the world's biggest trumpet festival in Serbia. And so as we explored that, found that Zlatna Juste was at the center of this whole scene in New York, and they could be our passport into this whole new land.
So it was the 50th anniversary of the Guča Festival. They call it a trumpet festival, but it's actually, Adam, it's a trumba, right? It looks like a trumpet held horizontally as opposed to vertically.
It's a truba.
Truba, right.
Anybody in the band will be very quick to point that out. It's a rotary valve flugelhorn. And that's right. It's held on its side for, I think, better dexterity with your fingers.
How big a deal is this festival?
This festival is the World Cup of Balkan brass music. There's a lot on the line for...
People biting each other? And...
probably. A lot of alcohol, and once that gets in your system, who knows what happens.
Yeah, yeah. But then they go to Serbia, and, you know, they kind of make a good case for themselves, don't they?
Yeah, they... For them, it's kind of a homecoming. They've appropriated this music away from its source, and 30 years after their inception, they're able to go back and kind of play in competition for the very first time, kind of match up against these trumpet masters in a land where trumpet is king,
right?
And see how they stack up. So that's kind of the main narrative force behind the film.
We're speaking with Brian Chang and Adam Pogoff, the producers of the movie Brasslands, which follows the 50th annual festival, the so-called Trumpet Festival in Guča, Serbia. The film is screening twice here in New York at Lincoln Center, first as Global Fest, part of Global Fest, on Sunday the 27th at 1 p.m., and then it'll be part of the Sound and Vision Festival at Lincoln Center on Sunday, August 3rd, at 4:30 p.m. The soundtrack is great, and it is out now. So, Adam, Zlatan Ustaj goes to Serbia. You guys go to Serbia. And there, things get complicated.
Things get real.
Yeah.
Yeah, so at stake is, the Golden Trumpet. This goes to the winner of the Best Trumpet Player of the Year. And that's determined after a fierce competition in which national pride is represented, and even your yearly income could be determined by winning or not winning.
Mm.
So for our American characters, Zlatan Ustaj, this could be a validation of all their years of hard work to be recognized with a trophy. But simply getting there and being the American representatives is also big validation.
And being American in Serbia, you know, the war comes up, you know, there are people, you see bombed out buildings, and, you know, people are still talking about the United States as having bombed us. And yeah,
the scars are still pretty fresh, and one of the scenes in the movie shows a building that the U.S. and NATO bombed during the war not too long ago.
So there's that sort of subtext to things. Then there is another kind of subtext, which you know, gets mentioned at various points early in the part of the film where you are in Serbia, and it gets progressively more evident as things go on. Because, Brian, you were essentially following, in addition to Zlatan Ustaj, two of the bands from Serbia. One of them is Demiran Cherimović and
right.
his orchestra. Who is Demiran?
Demiran is a Roma musician, or colloquially and perhaps derogatively known as gypsies in the area. And so this is kind of a different sect of the Balkan brass music tradition. The South Serbians are these Roma bands, and then West Serbia you find the white Serbian bands. And so what attracted us to this story to begin with was that all these different bands were playing the same exact music, but for totally different reasons. So you have these Americans who have appropriated it. You've got these white Serbs who are playing the music as a token of oftentimes their nationalism and their national pride. And then the Roma musicians, it comes from more of a Turkish-influenced musical background. And for them, a lot of times these musicians, it's one of the only ways they can really elevate their stock in life and be considered people in civilization, where often they're on the fringes of society. And so, as you see with Demiran's character, they're really battling for recognition and for legitimacy.
You really end up rooting for this guy. And I'm sure the Zlatan Ustaj guys were too, because they have studied Demiran's band and his style of playing. This is Demiran Cherimović and his orchestra with the Demiran Čoček.
We'll be right back.
So that is Demiran Cherimovic and his orchestra with the Demiran Chocek. The Chocek is a kind of a circle dance, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I know you guys are both musicians. Who can tell me what rhythm that was?
Ooh.
Yeah, I thought so. So this is one of the bands you guys are following in the film Brasslands. That's the
right.
Big trumpet festival and competition there in Guča, Serbia. The other band, Adam, is Dejan Petrovic and his orchestra. Now, Brian was talking about, you know, the Roma, the gypsy bands, and then you have the white Serbian bands. He represents the latter. Why did you choose him?
Well, to be honest, that was a bit of luck. We had a hot lead going into Serbia that this guy, Dejan Petrovic, is the reigning champ. He's won a few years in a row leading up to the festival, and so we thought, that was a good enough reason to follow him. Turned out,
he's also from a family of champion trumpeters.
That's right. He's a fourth generation trumpet player, his father and grandfather having won the Guča competition.
So, I mean, as I alluded to before, you know, there's some talk early on, and I would play the clips, but they're all in Serbian, won't do us a whole lot of good on the radio, but someone is talking about, Brian, what you mentioned, the difference between the South Serbian and the West Serbian styles. And eventually you get to people talking pretty baldly about black and white, you know, musicians. And there's some very casual racism at play here.
Yeah, that's something that we saw throughout as we were in Serbia, that there's a real divide in society between these different groups. And they represent different things that, they're called black and white musicians to the point where, you know, they're playing different styles. And at the festival, you can see, you know, there's all white bands and all so-called black bands who are the Roma musicians. And there's definitely a rivalry there. So that kind of plays into the competition aspect of the festival
as well. And a festival that you've both already told us is full of kind of nationalist fervor. Do things get really ugly?
I think with any other music festival, you know, the beer starts flowing and, you know, the beer starts flying. And I think when people get drunk, you know, whatever is simmering underneath kind of comes out. Mm. And there were certainly aspects of these nationalist Serbs coming in and going nuts to this music. What was really interesting is that they were coexisting with kind of these European hippies who were also really just into this music and like jamming out and enjoying the tunes. So it's really this crazy melting pot of all sorts of different people who just love the music.
Again, there's a lot on the line at this festival, and this was the 50th edition of the Guča Trumpet Festival in Serbia that Adam Pogoff and Brian Chang follow in their film Brasslands. We heard a little bit from the Roma musician Demiran Cherimovic. This is the Serbian musician Dejan Petrovic and his orchestra. That's a little bit of music from Dejan Petrovic and his orchestra from West Serbia, which becomes sort of code for white ethnic Serbian as opposed to the southern Serbs who are Roma or gypsy musicians. So guys, there are two battles going on here. There's the battle royale for trumpet supremacy in Serbia. You know, you have the West Serbians and the South Serbians. They're all in this competition together. Then there's this other competition for the international bands from Holland and Poland and Austria and good old Zlatne Uste from right here in New York. How hard was it to sort of follow both of those at the same time?
Yeah, that was definitely a tricky issue in the edit room, how to portray both of these competitions that were happening at the same time and have the climax of the film, you know, occur in a satisfying way. The international competition was the primary reason that we went over there. This was a first-time thing for the Guja Festival. For their 50th anniversary, they decided to open up the competition mm-hmm. to bands from all over the world. And really strikes at the heart of what we were trying to communicate right. with this film, that music can transcend political boundaries and that, you know, that people from all, not just Europe, but all over the world are going nuts for this music that's really very infectious, something very basic about it that I think people, when they hear it for the first time, they really resonate with it.
So the film is called Brasslands, and if you want to find out who wins the international competition and who wins the big intramural Serbian competition, you'll have a couple of opportunities to see the movie. Sunday the 27th at 1 p.m. as part of Lincoln Center's Global Fest. And then on Sunday, August 3rd at 4:30 p.m. as part of Lincoln Center's Sound and Vision Festival. The soundtrack is full of great music. It is out now. And we've been speaking with the producers of the movie Brasslands, Adam Pogoff, Brian Chang. Guys, job well done. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
We talked a bit about Latin music on today's show, and that'll continue tomorrow, because during the recent Latin Alternative Music Conference here in New York, I got to team up with Maria Hinojosa, host of the NPR program Latino USA, to welcome two great boundary-pushing artists to the green space, the Argentine musician Juana Molina and the New York-based psychedelic salsa band La Mecánica Popular. Hear their performances tomorrow. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.